This is a Women's Overseas Service League oral history project about a speech given by Mary Ann E. McBride MacKillop, capital M-C, capital B-R-I-D-E, capital M-C, capital K-I-L-L-I-P. She lives at 1054 Hayes, capital H-A-Y-E-S, in Irvine, California, zip 92720, telephone 714, area code 786-6705. Mary Ann was born in Anaheim, California, on December 21, 1964. She was commissioned in 1986 by the Ordnance Corps, U.S. Army Reserves. She had duty in Japan, Korea, Honduras, and stateside for numerous exercises, served on mobilization team for Operation Desert Storm Shield. And my name is Vivian Peterson. I live at 2319 P as in Paul, Via Peorta, capital V-I-A, capital P-U-E-R-T-A, Laguna Hills, California. My telephone number is 714 area code 830-9894. Mary Ann gave a speech at our meeting on Saturday, November 5, 1991, at the Glendale Federal Savings and Loan in Laguna Hills, California.
And as we got acquainted, about that time, the war started over in Saudi Arabia, and then we understand that her daughter that was involved. And so today we have the pleasure of having Mary Ann McBride, as she was listed on our publicity, but she went and got married, so now her name is Mary Ann MacKillop. So without a lot of fuss and bother, she can tell you about her experiences as to what women are doing in the army right, or in the military right now. Okay.
And her mother.
And her mother. Of course, mine was scheduled.
Yeah,
I did shorter. I promised her a year to get the dress done, and I only gave her, nine months. Good afternoon. My name is Lieutenant Mary Ann MacKillop, and I'm in the United States Army Ordnance Corps, which is my area of expertise is maintenance. Not only missile munitions maintenance, tank automotive maintenance, almost anything but aviation maintenance. So the soldiers that work for me include mechanics, electronic equipment, generators, almost anything that needs a wrench to fix it is what my guys and my girls do. I was commissioned through the Army ROTC Reserve Officer Training Course in 1986. From Cal State Fullerton, locally. In the past 7 years, I've traveled to Japan, Korea, and Honduras in different training capacities. I spent 2 3-week tours in Japan for an exercise called Yamasakura. It was what's called a command post exercise. It's a computer-generated war that we react and proact to. In Korea, every year there's an exercise called Team Spirit. Team Spirit 87, Team Spirit 88, and that's an exercise with the Korean government and the United States Armed Forces, kind of preparing for the defense of Korea in the event of an invasion from the north. I was there in 1987. I was there for 6 weeks. In 1988, I was there for 4 months as site support. I spent 3 weeks in Honduras for an exercise called Fuertes Caminos or Freedom Road, and that was done in 1989. And the United States Army Engineer Corps was building a road through Honduras to facilitate the growth of the country. just allowing the civilians in Honduras to be able to get around their own country a little bit easier. We also built schools while we were down there, and I was part of the maintenance support that supported the engineer company with keeping their equipment running. In August of 1990, my unit came up on the list of units that were scheduled to deploy to Operation Desert Shield. I was at that time a member of the 489 Light Equipment Maintenance Company out in San Bernardino, California as a reservist. I was activated to come in and get my unit ready to go. In September of 1990, it was determined that our unit was not going to go, but I was ordered to active duty at the headquarters 63rd Army Reserve Command in Los Alamitos to assist in the mobilization of other units. In addition to being an ordnance officer, I have a secondary in personnel and in administrative, or AG, Adjutant General Corps. As part of this mobilization team, I assisted in the deployment of 22 units, three of which stayed within continental United States, 19 of which went to Saudi Arabia and Bahrain, United Emirates, and some into Kuwait. We had a total of 2,700 soldiers deployed. Of the 2,700, 350 were female women soldiers. That was a small portion of the total 65,000 women that deployed in support of Operation Desert Shield and Storm, but those were our local people. The types of units that we deployed into Operation Desert Shield and Storm included transportation units, quartermaster, which was a supply, not only general supply and field service companies, but also water purification units. Also, we had the field service companies included bakery sections, graves registration, or now they call memorial services, laundry bath units, and renovation, which is the repair of canvas equipment and uniforms. We also had maintenance units, both forward direct support units that go right out there and fix the stuff right on site, as well as general support, which is where they evacuate the equipment farther back to be fixed. We also had several medical units from the California, Nevada, and New Mexico areas deploy. And we had a military police unit, and we also had instructors from our reserve schools deploy to assist in the training of soldiers in country and in the continental United States. The types of jobs that the female soldiers held during Desert Storm included that of drivers. They not only drove pickup trucks and what we call the Cub V, it's like a Bronco. We also had them driving the huge HETs. They're like a heavy equipment transport truck. They drove big rigs, is really what they were doing. We had mechanics working on everything from tank tracks to tank turrets, generators, trucks, electronic equipment, communication and signal equipment, anything that was broken they were fixing. The female soldiers were deployed as military police. They went over there and worked at port security. When the ships would come in with all of the equipment, these women were part of the military police detachments that provided security at the ports. We also had the soldiers go over in the areas of cooks and bakers in the field service companies. They did admin services. They provided support in memorial services. They were and there were very few casualties on the American side, but they did also support the processing, collection, and administrative support for the Iraqi dead. So that was an area that the female soldiers from our own local units were involved in. And we also had our own soldiers involved in medical support. They worked in the combat support hospitals, the evacuation hospitals, and the general hospitals that were deployed overseas. On the active duty side, we had soldiers deployed in signal communications. They worked as communication satellite operators. They worked in aviation areas. The only aviation area that was cut off to women during Desert Storm was that of the Apache helicopter. They worked on transport. They flew helicopters into the areas for evacuation. Female helicopter pilots in the United States Army went everywhere the men could go except into the combat roles with the Apache helicopters. They were also involved in field artillery and air defense artillery. You've heard a lot about the Patriot missile. That is one battery that women are allowed into in the air defense, in air defense artillery branch. And there were women women commanded batteries in Desert Storm.
I had no idea.
Also, for the first time in history, women were put into, or not put into, but women were already in commander positions and in senior non-commissioned officer positions. And it was the first time in history that there was not a question of whether or not the woman should go in that capacity. During Grenada in 1983, there was an MP company from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, deployed to Grenada in the first wave. It was turned back because there were women in the unit. The women were turned back. I said, you can't go with your unit. We're not sure if we're going to send you or not, strictly because you're a woman. 3 days later, they said, okay, now you can go. When they got to Grenada, they said, no, you're not supposed to be here, and they sent them back again. 3 days later, they turned back and finally allowed them into country. And at that point, they needed to make a decision. The military needed to make a decision as to whether or not the soldiers in the military, the female soldiers in the military, were going to be Kelly girls and be temps during time of peace. And when the balloon goes up, be sorry, honey, you got to stay home. So during the next 10 years, or the next 9 years, they made the decision that women could do the job. And when Desert Storm came up, they didn't question whether or not that female commander or that female NCO should go in that capacity. If the female commander was there, she was sent. Also in Panama, 6 months earlier, in Operation Just Cause, women proved themselves in the combat zone. With the military police company that was sent was commanded by a woman, Captain Andrea Bray, and she was involved in a direct firefight on a position that was not expected. And it was realized that they could do the job just as well as any other soldier. Some people have asked me if the women in Desert Storm were treated any differently, strictly based on their sex. I spoke with some friends of mine who did go overseas. And one of my friends was Lieutenant Ann Hurley. She is a maintenance control officer with the 503rd Maintenance Company Direct Support Forward out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina. She's a West Point graduate from 1987. And she and I were best friends at Officer Basic Course. And she gave me these accounts. She said that when it came down to it, the male and female soldiers didn't have anybody else to depend on but themselves. And that the male soldiers realized that they couldn't do it alone. And she said the more time they spent in the desert, the discrimination tended to disappear. There were less accounts of harassment, less accounts of discrimination, because the more time they spent together, the more the women proved that they could do the jobs that they were required to do. She also said that once they say combat zone, everybody's getting an extra $110 a month. They're all doing the same job for the same pay. And they were treated fairly, and they were treated equally. She also pointed out that the female soldiers in Desert Storm showed the Arabs that women's place is not always in the home or behind the veil. She said that her unit was visited by several Saudi and Arab generals and dignitaries, and from other foreign countries as well, and they were impressed by the job that the female soldiers were able to do, that they commanded the units and that they commanded their sections, and that the male soldiers treated them fairly and equally. And the restrictions that you heard about with the sleeves down, you couldn't look the male Arabs in the eyes, you couldn't work out in the open, and you couldn't work without your DCU, the desert camouflage jacket on, those restrictions tended to go away. She said that by October of 1990, most of those restrictions had gone by the wayside, because the Arabs realized that the female soldiers weren't going to run downtown in tank tops and shorts and disrupt their religion and their culture. So after that October, things to kind of calm down, and they didn't seem to have a problem with the female soldiers per se. She said that they had more problems with their own commanders still worrying about that, it was still coming down, kind of like latent regulations from above. It was still being pushed down that soldiers shouldn't be outside without their jackets on, but in 130-degree heat, it seemed pretty ridiculous. Overall, since 1975, the training of soldiers, both male and female, has changed. When they opened up the quotas for women in the military, in all of the armed forces, they realized that they needed to train the male and female soldiers on the same level. And basic training is still separate for the enlisted soldiers. For the officers, once you're an ROTC cadet, you go through training right alongside the male soldiers. When you go through your basic course, your advanced course as a cadet, you train right along with the male soldiers. From sunup to sundown, you're in the same stuff they are. Ranger swim test, jumping off the, rappelling down 80-foot cliffs, everything is the same. And you're supposed to do it just like they do. On the enlisted side, they have separate basic trainings at different locations. And then once they go into their advanced individual training, which is where they learn their MOS or skill, they are integrated. And they go through the training right alongside. They're in the same platoon, same squad with their male counterparts. And when I send my soldiers to training as a platoon leader and as a future commander, they go through the same training. The only time that they are separated is in billeting. And, when I need to, and at times during Desert Storm, male and female soldiers shared the large GP medium and GP large tents. They just threw a blanket up if necessary, threw blankets up, and they had separate quarters but the same tent. And that did not pose problems as was expected. Out of 467 MOS skills and military occupational skills in the United States Army today, only 37 are closed to women, and those are in the combat areas, which shows that I think there's been 35 different positions that have finally been open to women in the past 4 years. And I guess that kind of brings us to the present. Does anyone have any questions for me? It's mainly in the infantry skills. It also includes in field artillery, armor, infantry. A lot of the field artillery positions are closed to women. Air defense artillery, because it's farther back, tends to be more open to women, like I said, in the Patriot batteries and in some of the large missile batteries. They are open to that.
What have you been trained in?
I've been trained in the maintenance area. I've kind of had some real different positions. In Korea, I was a lone agreement officer during Team Spirit 88. And for 4 months, I signed for go to war stock, jeeps, trucks, water buffaloes, which is really a big trailer. And I signed for all this equipment, and then we loaned it to the units that were there for training. And they kind of create like a big scenario of a war. And they had actual support. They broke vehicles, so we fixed them. They needed to be fed, so we transported food and petroleum to them. And so it was a live mission for a period. The actual exercise is only 2 weeks, but you have 2 months build up before the exercise and then 2 months build up or build down after the exercise to get equipment repaired and turned back in.
Who took the armament on that trip? You had to sign for it.
Oh, I had to sign for everything. And the only thing that was really lousy, I had to sign for 600 sleeping bags. And the ROK soldiers, the Korean soldiers that showed up to as part of this joint force, didn't have anything. I mean, they showed up with the uniforms on their back and the trucks that they were driving in, and that was it. So we had to provide them food, shower facilities, and sleeping bags. And I'm trying to explain to this Korean captain that this is a hand receipt and he's going to need to sign for these and that I want them back, we didn't have anybody to interpret for us or translate, so I went out there every night to make sure they hadn't left. I think out of 100 sleeping bags, we only had 6 that found their way into permanent status, and I think we wrote those off as a gift to the Korean government. But, we I think that was it. Those six left in the middle of the night. I never did find out where they went.
Let me ask a personal question.
Sure.
Do you plan to stay in the military?
Yes, I do. I plan to make it a career.
Is your husband military?
No, he's not military. He's presently an architect student in his senior year at Cal Poly Pomona. And he's very proud of the fact that I'm in the military. And he supports me in every way as a military spouse. But he himself is not interested in it, though, I should say.
Are you still in the reserve?
Right now, I'm active reserve. And I'm pending orders for a 4 or 5 month, a 5 year period. I've requested to go on a program called Active Guard Reserve, which would be as a full time support for a reserve unit.
Is there any problems with like rape there?
Very little. I've talked to. I'll tell you the problems with rape that they had were handled in country by the leadership there. And it was no different than any other place. It wasn't accelerated due to the war. And they were handled with court-martials in country. We didn't have any rampant problem with that. And one thing that I noticed in the news, they really played up when this thing about women being in combat roles, when it was on the congressional floor, they brought up the fact that there were numerous pregnancies during Desert Storm. I wanted to address that, and I wasn't sure if I should bring it up. The women, a lot of the women that showed up pregnant in Desert Storm and Desert Shield actually were deployed pregnant. They were deploying so many soldiers through such a quick mobilization process that a lot of them were not tested properly when they left. My friend that went over there in August of 1990 was at Fort Bragg, which is NASA's component post, and they are, because of the type of unit they are, they're supposed to be ready to go in 24 hours. And she was given 24 hours notice and then was deployed. They didn't do any sort of medical screenings because it was assumed that they were ready to go. Turned out she was 3 days pregnant when she deployed. And she stayed until, she left in August and she came back in January of 1991. Didn't tell anybody. Just finally, right after Christmas, she said, excuse me. My units, they're all good to go and they're all settled in and I think I need to go home for a few months. And she had her baby in May. But she had no idea when she left that was the status.
She didn't want to come back until her men were off.
Right. Most of the female soldiers that found themselves in that situation stayed until the last moment before they came home. And a lot of them were within the restrictions of the war, were able to go back and join their units after a 6 week maternity leave.
Are a husband and wife allowed in the same units, or is there a restriction?
There's no restriction with that, but they do have to have a family care plan. In the 2,700 soldiers I deployed, we had several husband and wife teams or husband and wife families that deployed together. We did have a problem where we had a lack of a family care plan. They had not identified someone to take care of their children in the event of mobilization. If that could be corrected, they both went. If not, I was given the option, I gave them the option of transferring one of the members into another unit until they could get the family care plan taken care of.
Mm. Is there a quota system on enlisting in that you're going to have X number of thousands of soldiers that so many are women and so many are men, or is it first come, first serve, so to speak?
Yeah, I asked that of a recruiter, and what she told me was that month to month their requirements change.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe 1 month they need a certain IQ or a certain geographical location or a certain sex or a certain race. But the overall, there is no real quota specifically for that. The number of women has, just in the past few years, is up to, I think it jumped in 1975 through 1980. It jumped from like 18,000 of the original converts, that they converted over to the branches, up to 58,000.
Mm-hmm.
And it's jumped, it's going rampant. I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of female soldiers in the military, in all branches.
Can I ask you a question? Do the difference ethnic groups get along well with the military? I just retired school teacher, and there's been a lot of discussion amongst teachers I know from different areas who maintain that the children are not interacting as well as they might from the different, so many different ethnic groups. Is that true in the military?
Well, they,
when I was in the Marines, everybody was white.
Mm-hmm. They say that in the, you know, the military is a microcosm of the world around it. And we've had problems in different areas. We've had problems with race relations and yes. And in the desert, from what I understand of the accounts coming back, we did have problems with different racial groups, depending on the makeup of the unit.
Calling each other names?
Calling each other names, getting in fist fights, just
the usual.
Just the usual.
You mean the men. They always fight,
right?
Right. The women don't do that.
Not as much. I have to admit, I went through basic training at Fort Knox, Kentucky. And this was ROTC cadets, mind you. And I had 9 girls in my unit. And of the 9, 7 of them were black. And it was a reverse discrimination. They felt that because they were black, they were being treated differently. And that they had to do more work and this, that, and the other thing. As it turned out, it was because there were more of them than there were of us, that they were pulling more duty. It was all the same amount, but the impression was that we were getting off, you know, without doing something. And I don't think it ever went to blows, but there was friction there. And that was back in 1983. And I think it's gotten a lot better. There's a very strong EEO system in the military, equal opportunity, it's not really tolerated. My first troop unit that I was involved in, I just left, was the 489th. It's out in San Bernardino, California, and my first platoon was 95% Hispanic. The other 5% was black. Actually, I guess 4%. I had 2 white soldiers.
You were the total loss of that.
Right? Yes, I was 1 of 3. And
I say that because I'm the only blue-eyed person in the place, but I have lost.
And these guys, when I first walked in there, they thought, boy, they thought they saw me coming. And it took me about 2 months before I sat down with the senior NCOs, and I kind of told them how the hog ate the cabbage, that I was not right off the street, that I looked real young, but that I'd been around, and that this was the way we were going to play this game. And to this date, they still call me for advice and support. Even though I've moved on to the battalion level, I'm still within the same battalion, but I've moved on to the S1 slot at battalion. And they still call me to say, you've got to talk to this platoon leader I've got now, he's not doing this. I say, no, wait a minute, you've got to train him like you train me. And they're like family. So.
Good.
Mm. I have to tell you, I did have to get involved in keeping them from hitting each other a couple of times.
What percentage of the women are married? That are in
this service. Wow, I know within the 63rd ARCOM it's probably 50%. And it's like any other situation, you know, the younger soldiers, most of them are not. As they get older, a lot of them are. And a lot of them are married, a lot of them are dual service families. They'll have both family members are in the military reserves, the Army reserves. I dated a couple of guys, though, in the Army, and I wouldn't marry one.
Well, you chose the right one. According to the pictures,
the question was, what did I do for the deployment and the mobilization of the unit? We had 3 different mobilization sites locally, and what that is it's the active duty sites where we sent our units so that they could be medically screened, that they could receive additional combat skill training, that they could receive additional MOS skill training before they deployed overseas. And most of our units went through one of these 3 sites. One was Fort Ord, California, up in Monterey, California. One was Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And the other one was Fort Irwin, California, out in the lovely desert. And so one of my jobs was to, before the unit was deployed, it would come up on a list saying that this was a unit that was going to be sent, and they received an alert notice. So when we received that alert, we knew that within 3 days they would receive an order. At that alert, we would go out to the unit, and one of my jobs was to screen their personnel list, their manning roster, and identify who was deployable, who was not deployable, and who I was going to have, what shortages they had skill-wise. And then I had the authority to cross-level soldiers up to a 500-mile radius. So I would call Private Snuffy's unit and say, Private Snuffy is now needed in this unit, and you will have him transferred over in 24 hours. that soldier has 4 to 8 hours to get his equipment packed and ready to go, and he'll be going with this unit. Mm. So we were cross-leveling people all over the place. We were switching them from a California unit, moving them to a Las Vegas unit, then they would go on to Huachuca. If they were in a, maybe their skill was needed and they lived in Alaska, but they were part of a unit here, we shipped them down and they went with the unit here. So we did a lot of cross-leveling of people during Desert Shield, Desert Storm. In addition to that, I was a liaison with Sixth Army and with the mobilization sites to make sure that if they did have problems, we could correct them. That some of the non-deployable problems we had, funny enough, it wasn't the pregnancies that they talked about. A lot of it was pre-existing conditions, pre-existing injuries that were not noted in their medical files. The guy would show up and you found out he had a heart murmur that he really didn't even know about. He wasn't deployable, they'd send him home. Maybe, one thing that was funny, if they had braces and could not take them off,